Good morning. This is Per Fogren, KBOO Talk Radio. We'll get right into our program. Our guest is Heather Woka. She's a writer, and she, she'll tell us who she writes for a variety of journals. I read an article by her on Truth Out, which was came from Common Dreams, and so I think we'll talk about that. Heather, are you there?
Yeah, I sure am, and thanks again for the invitation.
Oh, welcome to KBOO.
Yeah, great.
Anyway, I read your article, World War III or Bust, the implications of a U.S. attack on Iran. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, my background is actually in clinical psychology, but I've been an educator for probably 20 years, and just maybe, well, quite frankly, when Bush went into office, I became a blogger because I was so angry about the things that were going on, and so I would just research them for myself, and then I thought, hang on, you know, I bet other people would like to also have this information, so I just started blogging, and then it has really kind of mushroomed from there. I've got a website that I would invite people to come visit, and it's this is basically how I got started.
I see. Well, why don't you give us the name of that website?
Yeah, my last name is a little bit unusual. It's Vokush, and so the website is www.heathervokush.com. That's going to be HEATHERWOKUSCH.com.
Okay, well, let's get into the articles. A lot of stuff in there, all the things that can happen if the U.S. does attack Iran. And, well, it's starts right out with a real great kind of a little metaphor or simile, I don't know. Witnessing the Bush administration's drive for an attack on Iran is like being a passenger in a car with a raving drunk at the wheel. I think that kind of sums it all up. I mean, we got these maniacs in Washington, and we're really kind of helpless in some ways. I mean, they can, boy, they can get us all in trouble, can't they?
Well, they can get us into trouble, but I would argue that actually we aren't as helpless as we think we are, and that there are really positive bits of action that we can take. And as, certainly, especially, for example, in relation to this whole attack on Iran, I can tell you that with this, you know, alleged or proposed attack on Iran, I can tell you after I wrote this article, I've been getting literally hundreds of emails per day, literally hundreds. And there are two main themes. One is, oh no, you scared the crap out of me, quote. So this is one. But then the other is, what do I do? You know, I feel so helpless. And I believe that we can't just let it, you know, finish there because that leads to apathy. And, you know, we drank the Kool-Aid last time going into Iraq. We cannot do it again. And so while we're on the topic now, I would really, if anybody out there really wants to get involved and is not sure how, I would really highly suggest heading on over to a website called campaigniran.org. And that's all one word, campaigniran.org. And they've got a really good section on what you can do, you know, things like, you know, writing letters to the press and to local radio and contact anti-war groups, what have you. And then they also have some good articles on the topic. So I think the first thing is not to feel disempowered.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things you say right in the first paragraph is that this is a little bit new to me, that Dick Cheney's office and the Pentagon has developed a, quote, last resort aerial assault plan using long-distance B-2 bombers and submarine-launched ballistic missiles with both conventional and nuclear weapons. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, that's the part that has to really give you pause. Now, I should say that this information came from a magazine called The American Conservative, and so this is not some lefty thing that people can make fun of. It was, this information came from a former CIA officer whose name is Philip Giraldi, and it's, we can assume the guy has, you know, information that's correct. Now, in relation to this, the whole idea of the states actually using, you know, so-called a tactical nuclear weapon, it's very interesting to note that last week the U.S. conducted another subcritical nuclear test. I don't know if you heard about this. Now, this is the ninth subcritical nuclear test under Bush. And subcritical means that there was no self-sustaining nuclear chain reaction, and so they think that that makes it easier to get, you know, by the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. But the bottom line is we are testing our nuclear weapons now, and so that's really something to kind of ponder. And, yeah, and so there is the possibility that we could actually be using nuclear weapons. And the reason is that they would use these so-called bunker busters because many of the targets that they have, and they have reportedly 450 targets that they want to hit in Iran, many of the targets are underground. And so they would use these bombs that can go way underneath and then explode things.
Well, that's really amazing, that many targets. Now, I did see an article, this came out of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, it's by Edward Lutwak, who's one of the war hawks around, and he, well, the headline on his article says it all, it could be done in one night. So, you know, he is saying, in spite of all the number of targets that I guess he's saying that there is just one or two or a few critical ones that will kind of kill the whole system. That just seems kind of a little bit nutty to me, but that's what some people think.
Well, you know, we had this similar predictions going into Iraq, that we would be greeted as liberators and children would be throwing rose petals at our feet and what have you. So clearly this isn't taking into consideration all of the, you know, but the reason that I wrote this article is to ask the question, okay, what then? You know, what if we actually did do this? What happens the next day? And clearly that writer was not taking questions such as this into consideration. I mean, at the very least, we have to look at the fact that if the United States or Israel were not to use a nuclear weapon, but if they were to bomb a nuclear reactor in Iran, well, my goodness, that would send a radioactive cloud over the Gulf. Mm-hmm. And the Oxford Research Group predicted that up to 10,000 people would die just if the U.S. bombed Iran's nuclear sites. Now, if then the U.S. used nuclear weapons, you know, in the process, well, then, of course, the radioactive fallout would become much worse and, you know, and the long-term damage and the deaths and who knows what. So clearly this gentleman is being a bit optimistic.
Yeah, and here's another article from Haaretz. This is an Iranian advisor saying that if they are attacked, they will attack the Israeli nuclear facility at Dimona.
You know, that's funny because I'm looking at the same article right here. So, yeah. Yeah, and then also the place, you know, Haifa with all of the chemical factories and the oil refineries. And so one of the things I mentioned in the article is this whole idea of the rapture-seeking folks who want the end times. But clearly, I mean, if we talk about, you know, bombing nuclear sites here and chemical factories there and using nuclear weapons, that is pushing us a little bit too close to the whole end time scenario.
Well, my end time scenario would be a lot of clothes and wallets and car keys lying around on the sidewalk, so I just sort of help myself, I guess.
Well, that's one way to do it.
But, so what are some of the other things that could happen? Now, you know, Iran could, you know, it seems to me could very easily strike at shipping in the Persian Gulf. I mean, they have a long mountainous coastline on one side of the Persian Gulf, and they have some state-of-the-art missiles. I think they get them from Russia. You know, I mean, it seems to me they could knock out shipping very easily. No more oil tankers at all coming from there.
Right, and you know, the interesting thing is what we're talking about there, there's this little passage called the Straits of Hormuz, and this is where the bulk of these big, you know, ships go through in order to leave that area. And so clearly they could just down a couple of ships and then block the place. But you know what's really interesting to think about, Per, in relation to all of this? You know, everybody's talking about this whole thing with the UAE, United Arab Emirates, and getting the port deal. Well, I mean, just in looking at a map, on the other side of the Straits of Hormuz is what? It's the United Arab Emirates. And so one can imagine that, well, perhaps that the States has gotten a nice deal with the United Arab Emirates, perhaps to put, you know, airplane launching pads or bases or something there in order to develop some kind of incursion into Iran. So I think that it isn't unlikely that these two events actually are connected, even though the media isn't really talking about them that way.
Well, apparently, I've been reading that the, you know, the war at large here in Washington, you know, they would, try and seize control of the Straits of Hormuz. They would also, seize the, you know, the oil-rich area in Iran, which is right next to Iraq and Saudi Arabia, you know, at the end of the Persian Gulf. Mm-hmm. And I guess they've been, sort of scoping out the population there who are not, they're not Persian, they're more Arabs, and so that I guess they think they could seize that part of Iran, so they'd have a whole lot of oil then.
Yeah, the place you're talking about, Khuzestan province, that actually has 90% of Iran's oil, and I believe 30% of its water supplies, and that borders Basra in Iraq. And so there's a number of reasons, because right in between the state of Hormuz and this Khuzestan province, right in the middle there is one of these huge nuclear reactors that they want to get rid of. And they also want to stop Iran from sending insurgents into Iraq, you know, via the border over there. And so there's a lot of reason that the Bush administration would want that lower, that southern area of Iran, would want to be able to control it. And so another thing to look at here is, you know, what are the real motivations for us going in there? Because the whole idea of the nuclear weapons, I mean, even U.S. intelligence agencies say that a nuclear weapon is, you know, 3 to 10 years away from being developed. And so as you had said, okay, well, one reason, you know, is to get this oil in that section. But another reason, and in fact, that's how we got into contact in the first place, is through this oil market that they are wanting to open up.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, there have been a few people saying that, well, even if Iran did start this oil bourse in selling oil for euros, that it wouldn't be, it wouldn't matter that much. But then I got a, I'm on the email list. There's a sort of an investor's website called Money and Markets.
Mm-hmm.
And why should we worry about the new Iranian oil bourse? And he says three reasons. Even if their market is illiquid at first, that could change quickly. In other words, it could start out small and gather momentum. Mm-hmm. Reason two, Iran will find the technical expertise is easy to buy. And reason number three is that Iran's share of the global oil market may not be huge, but, you know, considering the little leeway the oil market has, it's big enough. So, you know, the investors are clearly concerned also.
Yeah, and I would add another thing to that list that I don't know if you heard, but last week Norway announced that it also wants to have its own energy trading bourse in euros for crude oil and natural gas contracts, things like that. So, you know, what are we going to do? Try to bomb Norway? It looks as if this, you know, could, you know, be the wave of the future. It really looks to be that way. And then we need to look at, okay, what are going to be the economic implications for the United States?
Well, of course, Norway would retaliate by flooding the U.S. with lutefisk, I guess, or something.
I guess anything is possible. But do you also know about the whole M3 thing that the Fed has pulled?
I've heard they're not announcing that anymore. I'd like to know more about that. So, yeah, tell us.
Yeah, so these things clearly are connected. I mean, it's interesting that officially as of March 20th, this Iranian oil trading market is supposed to open.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, as of March 23rd, the Fed has announced that no longer is it going to release this money supply data that's called M3. And what that says is it talks about how much money is in circulation, but this M3 stuff includes the dollars that are circulating overseas, you know, the foreign currency holdings. And so what that means basically is, you know, when the Fed gets into trouble, it just, you know, prints money, prints money, prints money. And so what they, but, you know, this M3 data at least tells people how much money is going overseas. For example, last year, this M3 increased by over $700 billion. Now, we have to keep in mind that also next month, the States is going to hit its foreign trade debt ceiling. It's going to be like $8.1 trillion. So, you know, and it's so interesting that, of course, next month with this Bolsa open is when they decide to say, okay, well, we're not going to tell you anymore how much money is going overseas. So it's kind of like, you know, we have maxed our credit card and we know that the company is going to, you know, call us and they are trying to just pretend like it didn't happen or something.
Well, that should be very reassuring to all the people who hold the U.S. debt, you know, that they no longer know how many worthless checks are out there and circulating.
Yeah, you know, and that's got to be pushing people towards selling the dollar too. So it's, they just aren't really handling this in a way that would be beneficial for the economy of the United States long term. Clearly, it's as if they either they're not thinking about it, or they don't care, or this is part of the grand plan somehow. I mean, who knows? But this doesn't look good.
Well, I guess in the long term, you know, there are only so many ways of dealing with such a huge debt that we have. Of course, one is to tax people and pay it off, which seems to be unthinkable. And the other, you know, I mean, it looks to me like the main strategy right now is that the U.S. would inflate its way out. You know, cheapen the dollar so you're paying off this debt in dollars that are worth even less than they are now. And, you know, that would just sort of strike at the heart of the whole world financial system, seems to me.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
I mean,
yeah.
Other nations would follow suit, you know. Like everybody would say, oh, well, we'll just kind of no longer pay our debts. Which might not be a bad idea, but...
Yeah, but also, I mean, what is this, you know, if this is to happen, okay, so as you say, of course, the dollar's value drops and our import prices rise and the banks will raise interest rates and inflation will rise and all of these things will happen. Just on, okay, we can talk about things that would happen on an international market level, but how this is going to affect people back home is also significant. So one thing that you said, that's one way to get out of it, but you know, when you think about the fact that we now are spending like $7 billion a month on military operations only in Afghanistan and Iraq, one could imagine that we could also start, you know, saving a bit of money in certain places and investing it into helping our economy rather than, you know, just kind of throwing it away overseas.
Well, here in Portland, we have a little crisis in our school budget, mm-hmm. and I think we're something like $58 million short, and the $58 million is just about the cost of one fighter plane.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know what? Let's look at the education budget. You know, because I'm a career teacher, so this is something that gets me all the time. Bush's 2007, you know, fiscal year 2007 budget calls for $54.4 billion. His discretionary spending on education would be $54.4 billion. Now, as we just said before, there's $7 billion a month on military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. So what that means in hard practical terms is that for fiscal year 2007, the administration proposes spending $30 billion more for military operations only in Afghanistan and Iraq than for education, for discretionary spending on education across the country. I mean, what kind of priorities are those?
Oh, boy, I don't know. Actually, it was the $58 million was equivalent to one Trident II missile. So just think, every time they shoot off a Trident missile, there goes one Portland school board shortfall. But I think we have a caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. I haven't been listening, so I don't know exactly what you're speaking of. I hope that I can address it, but I call in because I tried to get in yesterday. A guy, James, had called in and said, you have made government your God, right? And there was this big hoopla about that. And I couldn't get on and explain, and I thought I would try. Okay?
Sure.
What he's saying is, I think, is that you've made government your authority, and that it seems that some people believe that government can fix our problems, see? But I feel that, okay, this is why I love George Bush. He has epitomized for me, government cannot and will not fix our problems. Government exists to fix rich man's woes, leaving us in the throes of our own responsibility for we the people. So we thought when Abraham said, we the people, when Jefferson said, that was it, fait accompli, is this what we see in our world today? Government has never done anything that the people didn't agree, at least complicitly. Women's rights, government didn't give us that. We fought and some of us died for that. And the war in Vietnam, government certainly did not give in to peace of its own initiative. That was us, we the people, in the streets and bridges threatening to shut down Washington, D.C. If they didn't, that is not a gift. That is capitulation, no less. Government is not our friend. A government does not do friends. Government does dirt darn well. Government does graft great, does greed gratuitously, cronies only, war marching as before.
Well, that sounds like poetry.
It's trying. It's prose and poetry kind of mine, I guess.
Well, you know, when you say government, you know, I mean, there's all different brands. I mean, the public libraries are government, too.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would distinguish between, the military machine and things like the libraries and education and health services.
Exactly.
I would also distinguish between the federal government and the local government. I think the feds, as Katrina has showed, are pretty useless.
But can I just ask one thing, Per?
Mm-hmm.
This is the thing. See, it seems like, on a level, it would be nice, I guess, if like a big disaster would happen and government could come in and fix things. But it just reminds me of, I heard this like little talk show on NPR one day, and it was a little comedy thing. It's a quiz show, and they called around the country to do like a town of the week thing. So they called up to Alaska, right? And they asked the guy, what are you doing today? And he says, oh, we're out here fixing the road, you know? And he goes, wow, doesn't the county do that? And the guy says, oh, up here, we just do things by ourselves, for ourselves. And the whole audience erupted, and I couldn't see it, but it was obviously a standing applause, standing ovation. I mean, what a concept. Go out and just unplug the gutter, people. Do not call the county. Now, is there a place for government? Yeah, obviously. But it's just that when we put our belief in that they can fix social things, see, they won't do it. It's not in their, it's not on their agenda. I mean, until the people, those people in Washington are people just like you or I, and I'm telling you, I'm getting ready to take Michael Moore's advice, and run just for the heck of it. And my whole platform will be, I don't need it, man. I don't need the money. I have a job. I'm happy in my life. Don't you just want like one regular Joe down there with some kind of common sense and an idea about like what money is and where it comes from, you know?
Okay. Well, hey, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, in a way, Heather, you still there?
Yeah, sure am.
You know, it seems to me he mentioned, if there was another disaster and the government could fix, I would think that if there is another terrorist disaster, the people in Washington will use that'll be their trigger, their excuse to go after Iran. You know, they'll blame Iran for anything that happens.
Well, actually, Perry, I should let you know, remember this, that article I was talking about from the American Conservative that was written by this former CIA officer, and he's the one who talked about this. Well, there's a sentence in the article I will read you, and that is, the Pentagon, acting under instructions from Vice President Dick Cheney's office, has tasked the United States Strategic Command with drawing up a contingency plan to be employed in response to another 9-1-1-type terrorist attack on the United States. This plan is the Iran plan.
So the plan is there already, just waiting for the excuse.
Yeah, so my goodness, we had this horrible terrorist attack, and we have secret information that says that Iran was involved, therefore we have to retaliate, kind of thing, would be one possible scenario. Another scenario is that if Israel does go ahead and bomb one of the reactors, well, we can imagine that Iran would retaliate. And then if Israel were hit, well, then the Bush administration would go protect Israel. So there are a bunch of different scenarios potentially pushing us into this conflict there. But what you had said is indeed one of them, according to the CIA officer.
Well, it is 8 o'clock. This is KBOO Portland, and we're talking with Heather Wokesh, who is a writer, has written a good article, World War III or Bust. Now, Heather, you said you could be with us from 7:30 to 8. Do you have to go, or can you stick with us a while longer, or what?
You know, I am so sorry, but I am going to have to leave now, but I would love to be invited back at any time.
Can I just ask you one quick question?
Of course.
You're a clinical psychologist. You think Bush is kind of nuts?
Well, I should say, actually, I don't have a doctorate. I have a master's. So I would say, I would ask you, who's more nuts, Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld?
Well,
I would say that our administration is not behaving in a logical way with correct reason. Let me put it that way. But we, as the gentleman was saying before, I would suggest that we do have power to stop this. We aren't passive. We do have things to do. So as a last-minute note, I would encourage people to maybe check out campaigniran.org if they want to somehow get involved.
Okay, thank you very much. We've been talking with Heather Wokesh, who wrote this article, World War III or Bust, and she has a website, heatherwokesh.com. That's HeatherWokesh. And thank you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks so much, Per. Okay, thanks. Goodbye.
Bye. Okay, I guess I don't know if we have any announcements. Do we have any announcements to run? Well, I think we have one announcement. Oh, no, we don't. Oh, okay. I'm going to have to read something. Anyway, that has sort of started out to be our topic of this morning, but there are lots of other things you can talk about, too. The number to call here is 231-8187. There's so much going on, especially, in the Middle East. There is, this ongoing thing with Hamas winning their election in Palestine, which has gotten Israel retaliating by withholding tax and customs money that they owe to Palestine. And there's all this talk of kind of putting a siege around Palestine and Gaza, and it's just there is also the ongoing furor over the we have the cartoons, the great cartoon war, which has really aroused the population all throughout the Middle East. We have the question, the destruction of the Shia mosque in Samarra in Iraq, and I'm wondering who is really behind that. We could talk about that, but basically we can talk about anything that people want to talk about. But so here we have an announcement to read. Let's see. Distinguished philosopher Daniel C. Dennett, author of Darwin's Dangerous Idea and Consciousness Explained and Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, will be speaking tonight at 7:30 at the Volum Lecture Hall on the Reed College campus. This talk is sponsored by the Reed College Freethinkers. Tickets are free, but you must reserve tickets. There are a few tickets left. If you are interested in reserving a ticket to tonight's lecture by Daniel Dennett, call Leslie at 503-517-5292 this morning. That is Daniel Dennett. Article or book he wrote about consciousness explained. That should be a really interesting topic right there. This is something that has always intrigued me for years and years and years. How is consciousness related to the brain? I mean, the brain occupies space. It is sort of what we think of as a physical entity, but consciousness sort of occupies no space at all. But we know we have it. We should. Anyway, the number to call here is 231-8187. We've been talking with Heather Wolkish about the possible war and attack on Iran over their so-called their nuclear program. Might say that there's an article by William Beeman, who's a professor at Brown University, who says that, well, I'll just read it a little bit from his article. Every aspect of Iran's current nuclear development was approved and encouraged by Washington in the 1970s. President Gerald Ford offered Iran a full nuclear cycle in 1976. Now, this is when the Shah ruled Iran. Moreover, the only Iranian reactor currently about to become operative, the reactor in Bushehr, was started before the Iranian Revolution with U.S. approval and cannot produce weapons-grade plutonium. Now, this is something to keep in mind. The Bushehr reactor, a light water reactor, produces PU-240, PU-241, and PU-242. Although these isotopes could theoretically be weaponized, the process is extremely long and complicated and untried. To date, no nuclear weapon has ever been produced with plutonium produced with a kind of reactor in Bushehr. Moreover, the plant must be completely shut down in order for the fuel rods to be extracted, making the process immediately open to inspection and detection. That is William Beeman, a professor at Brown University. And what it means is that this whole scare about Iran, Iran producing nuclear weapons is really, it's a scam. It cannot happen. Even experts say that they couldn't do it for another 10 years. Now, the figure that Heather Wolkish gave a while ago, 3 to 10 years, was sort of came from the Pentagon. But other experts say it would take at least 10 years. So this is a big scam, and like we've been saying, is that the real reason for this big uproar is the prospect of Iran starting to sell its oil for euros, which would strike at our kind of dollar hegemony. It's what it could do. Essentially, the dollar is kind of like a bad check, but other countries have to take this check because right now oil is sold in dollars only. And if you can't buy oil unless you have dollars, that motivates other countries to hang on to their dollars to buy their own oil. But if oil starts selling for euros or any other currency, they don't need those dollars. They can dump them, and then that strikes the value of the dollar, which most experts I've read, financial experts, think that the dollar is overvalued by about 30% at least, maybe more, that the value of the dollar would go way down. What this would mean is that the dollar would buy much less here at home. Interest rates would go up because right now the what's keeping our economy afloat is that other countries are buying U.S. Treasury bonds. Well, one way to get them to buy the Treasury bonds is to raise the interest that they would receive. And so this is sort of a bad situation for us because it would mean that interest rates would go way up, and there goes the housing bubble if it hasn't burst already. So this is the reason for this Iranian war scare, you know, this for attack on Iran. So let's go on to our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm enjoying your discussion on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I have some family background from Iran.
Oh, okay.
And I just wanted to throw another dimension out and make your discussion a little more complicated.
Okay.
I've been reading a lot about some of the separatist movements in Iran, and it seems to me that everything that Bush has done since he came to office has kind of solidified the Mullah regime in Iran
mm-hmm.
from removing the Taliban, which freed up the flow of heroin back into Iran. And I don't know if you know this, but Iran has the highest heroin addiction rate in the world.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah. Another thing that they did was basically take out the only armed separatist movement that was still alive in Iran, which was the Kurdish movement. And I believe the U.S. Military went into northern Iraq and basically took their weapons away.
Oh, but really?
Yeah, they've been fighting an insurgency against the Iranian government for years.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. There's also the question of Iran's biggest ethnic group, which doesn't seem to get much coverage in the Western media, and I don't understand why.
Now, which group is that?
The latest numbers I looked at says that there's between 22 and 29 million Azeris in Iran.
Uh-huh, okay.
There are four provinces in Azerbaijan that are 90-plus percent populated by the Azeris.
Now, that's in northern Iran, right?
It's predominantly northwestern Iran, mm-hmm. but they live all over the country.
Okay.
And there's been a process of assimilation going on in Iran with these people for the last 75, 80 years. When the Qajar dynasty fell in Iran and the Pahlavi dynasty which was a puppet of the British government, was put in charge. I think it was in like 1913 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, since the Pahlavis took over, basically there's been a process of Persianification of Iran, which means only Farsi or Persian, which is actually the 37th dialect of Arabic.
Really?
I learned that the last... these linguists could not find a classification for the language other than in the Arabic family.
Uh-huh.
And it's because of the Arabification of Iran with the invasion of the Muslims. And then after that, when the Pahlavis took over, they kind of, you know, they started having this policy to Persianify everyone. And that includes the Azeris, who speak a Turkic language, and who are aligned with Turkey, and who also have a huge ally in the Republic of Azerbaijan.
Right.
And there is a huge movement now that is going on in northwest Iran, and everybody's ignoring it. What I'd like to see is more people starting to discuss this, and I've also heard that Israel is flying reconnaissance flights over the border between Turkey and Iran.
Mm-hmm. I've heard something like that. Yes.
Yeah, and if you Google the Kurdish or Kurdistan and the movement of the Kurds in Iran, you'll notice that Iran's government is actually moving. They have this policy of moving Kurds into areas that are predominantly Azeri, and which is forcing people into fighting each other over the land, which is, I believe, an attempt to divide and conquer there.
Uh-huh. Well,
also, I do have a little bit of a gripe against sort of the leftist thinkers, because I've been confronted with some of them who don't really agree with my thoughts on Iran, and they seem to think that I'm for the regime because I'm against I'm for the Bush policies since I'm against the regime in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true, and there seems to be a separation between people from the left in Iran or in America and the people in that are fighting a socialist movement in Iran. And I don't know if you remember, I mean, Iran has probably the Middle East's biggest socialist movement. And before the mullahs took over, I was in the streets with my dad during the protests against the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
And what most people on the street thought was that a socialist government was going to take over. Nobody even knew who Khomeini was until he actually came back from France, where he was in exile. And a lot of people believe that's when he drew up the plans for Iran, was with the help of the French and the Israelis.
I've heard things like that. You know, it's very interesting. There is a labor movement in Iran. I understand they had a big bus strike in Tehran recently. Maybe it's still going on.
There's a huge bus strike in Tehran, and there's also been a lot of strikes going on in Iran's second biggest city, which is also in the northwest Azeri area.
Mm-hmm.
The town's called, or the city's called Tabriz, and it holds, I believe it holds over 1 million people now. And it's really the industrial and business center of Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Another really important thing about the northwest of Iran is it's also the agricultural center of Iran. That's where Iran's domestic food production is mostly centered, is in the northwest and the northeast part of Iran.
Well, it's interesting you bring up the Azeris, because one of the scenarios that I've seen for an invasion of Iran involves a military move through Azerbaijan into that part of Iran.
Definitely, and I think the Republic of Azerbaijan, which was an old Soviet republic, which broke free from the Soviet Union.
But it's still a dictatorship.
Yes, it's a big dictatorship. It's funny, I was there in 1999, the big scandal in the country was about the current president, who came after his father, who was the president before him, who basically took power through a coup. Now, his father was able to change the constitution in Azerbaijan so that his son could take power after he was gone.
Right.
There was this big scandal about his son coming to Las Vegas and gambling away a few million dollars of the Azeri oil money, which is flowing out of the Caspian Sea.
So he's
got huge ties to, I believe, the Bush administration in Washington, and they basically give the thumbs up to the election that put him in power.
Uh-huh.
And also, there was a couple of people that were involved with the Poles in Azerbaijan who committed suicide.
Really?
To try and bring some attention to what was going on in the election. But none of this was picked up by the Western media either.
This is very interesting. You know, I just saw a thing in the news today on Agence France-Presse that Azerbaijan and Armenia have been having discussions for quite a while over this disputed territory of Karabakh,
right,
which is sort of it's an Armenian-populated area, but it's sort of surrounded by Azerbaijan territory, and the Azerbaijan government is saying that the talks have broken down, and they're sort of talking about some kind of war with Armenia resuming.
Well, that's really complicated as well. It's not. That's a kind of a simple explanation that's been given by the people who control the propaganda machines in the Caucasus. There's a really interesting book called. It's by Thomas Goltz, I believe his name is Goltz.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the area that you're talking about is called Karabakh,
right,
which means black soil or black garden because of its fertility. Thomas Goltz was in Karabakh during the invasion, and this is actually sovereign Azeri land, and the majority of the population that lived there were Azeris. When this war was going on in 1991, almost 1 million Azeris were displaced from their homes or ethnically cleansed from the land.
Oh, really? Okay.
And really, the last number I looked at, there was only 200,000 Armenians that lived in Karabakh. The interesting thing about this is this invasion has kind of carved an area out where Russia is able to export arms equipment and I'm sure they're exporting chemical and nuclear weapons equipment into Iran through this piece of land. Iran's government is aligned with Armenia, which is really strange because the Azeris are Muslims mm-hmm. and the Armenians are Christians. But in this case, Iran's government has chosen to take the Armenian side in the conflict, aligns them with
mm-hmm.
Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And Azerbaijan is sort of sandwiched in between the two big giants. And I believe that's why the U.S. is trying to use Azerbaijan as an agitation point, if not an invasion point.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at this point,
you keep hearing that what's going on now is kind of a modern version of the old great game of about 100 years ago when Britain and Russia were duking it out in that part of the world.
Oh, definitely. It goes back at least 100 years, and mm-hmm. really, if you look at the Caspian Sea area, the world's first oil boom actually happened in the Caspian Sea.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Russian czars and the British Empire were fighting over it so furiously. And I don't know. This is kind of off the point, but the Nobel brothers, who set up the Nobel Peace Prize, actually made their fortune from selling Caspian oil.
Oh, really?
Caspian gas, yeah.
Oh, I thought they were in the dynamite business.
Oh, I'm sure they were in that as well.
I think he invented dynamite or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know about the dynamite, but mm-hmm. I'm fairly certain that there's another book that I read this in that was called Blood and Oil in the Orient. I forget the writer's name, but he was a Jewish Azeri who is living in France right now, I think. I forget his name. But the book's called Blood and Oil in the Orient.
Well, I think our listeners really could learn a lot about that part of the world. It's just there's a lot we don't know, and
part of the problem is just we seem to be living in a society that is living with really bad amnesia and
yeah.
Attention deficit disorder, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I fight that on a daily basis and try to remember some of the significant historical events and tie them together with what's going on today. And you're absolutely right. There is an end game sort of being played out in the Middle East. And I'm starting to really question whether the mullahs in Iran and the Bush administration are actually enemies.
Well, it's that I've been hearing for quite a while that Khomeini was somehow allied with the CIA, and I could never pin it down, or really a lot of the Iranians I talked to denied that, so I really don't know, but it's just a sort of a rumor that I've heard. And of course the U.S., once Iran did have a secular democratic leader, and that was Mossadegh, and mm-hmm. Britain and the U.S. Had him kicked out back in 53.
Right.
So it's like, the U.S. May talk about all these fanatical mullahs and everything else, but, they seem to keep them in power by one means or another.
Exactly, and you just have to go back to the Reagan administration with the whole Iran-Contra affair.
All right.
Carter was removed. Iran was used as a platform to remove Carter from office and put Reagan in charge. And I'm pretty sure George W. Bush Sr. was the CIA director, or really high up in the CIA back then.
Well, I heard he was the guy who met with the Iranians in Paris.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's what I heard. Now, I don't know. Maybe somebody can call in and tell me I'm right or wrong,
Right. I'm not sure about that. But I do know the story. I don't know if you remember the big embarrassment for Carter when U.S. military convoy that mm-hmm. was supposedly going to rescue the hostages.
All right.
Was taken out in the desert.
Yes, and who was the commander?
Yeah.
Oliver North. Oh, this is a stranger. Thanks a lot for calling. We have a couple other callers on the line, and thanks for all that information.
Yeah, hopefully that'll get some discussion going.
You bet. Okay,
thanks.
Let's... Let's go on to our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
Great. Thank you for the history lesson.
Why, we're learning a lot today, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I'll leave it to you, Pear.
Well, there's a lot of stuff I never knew about either, you know?
Okay, can we talk about a little about my favorite subject?
What's that?
Palestine?
Sure.
Okay. As you may or may not know, Israel built illegal settlements along the West Bank.
Right.
Sharon, in a move of altruism, decided to tear those down.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, I thought, lovely of him. All right. But before he did that there, he went to the U.S. bank and took $2.5 billion out in order to resettle the settlers.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now,
isn't his son in prison now?
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. But that's probably another little...
A little corruption thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What's a little corruption in the family pair?
Hey, right, okay.
Yeah, right. So now that amounts to there... $250,000 for each settler.
Wow.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, the victims, the refugees from Hurricane Katrina, are going to be thrown out of the flop houses that they put them in.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to take away their three hots and a cot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have to fend for themselves. But we have enough money to give each Israeli settler $250,000 to restart their lives.
I know, yes.
Is there something wrong with this picture?
I think there's a lot wrong with that picture, yes. And a lot of those settlers have already gotten a lot of money to move to those settlements in the first place.
Right. So, Pear, the question for me is, and I'll take my answer up the air,
mm-hmm.
Where is the priority? Are resettling the Israeli settlers more important than helping the victims of Katrina put their lives back together? And have a lovely, lovely day. Thank you very much.
Well, that's a good question, yes. I mean, I would do everything to help the Katrina people. I also, if I was running things in Washington, I would tell Israel to get out of the West Bank, and then maybe there could be some... peace in that part of the world, because Hamas, which is being, everybody's saying, well, Hamas refuses to recognize Israel, but, what does that mean? One of the Hamas leaders was interviewed by the Washington Post, and he says, we say, let Israel recognize the legitimate rights of the Palestinians first, and then we will have a position regarding this. Which Israel should we recognize? The Israel of 1917? The Israel of 1936? The Israel of 1948? The Israel of 1956 or 1967? Which borders and which Israel? Israel has to recognize first the Palestinian state and its borders, and then we will know what we are talking about. They have said that, they will, if Israel will go back to its 1967 borders and go along with the Oslo agreements, which they have not upheld, then there can be at least a very, very long truce, and there could be possible recognition and all the rest of it. So this is another big smokescreen we're getting, where they're saying that Hamas refuses to recognize Israel. This is sort of a bogus charge that needs to be examined more carefully. And I think we have another caller on the air. Let's take our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, back to Baku. The Nobel brothers were in Baku along with the Rothschilds and also the Bolshevik newspaper was being printed out of the same area.
That's interesting.
And that always kind of made me wonder, it's the same old, same old.
Well, a lot of people rubbing shoulders in that part of the world, the great game.
And Ron Chernow said that the Rockefellers were trying to merge with the Rothschilds. it was kerosene that they were trying to monopolize at that time.
Oh, that's very interesting. Yeah, well, the Rockefellers have their fingers all over the world, the Amazon.
They were trying to sneak the Rothschilds over to get a congressional hearing, and it was during the Chicago World's Fair when Rockefeller was building University of Chicago, and they thought the World's Fair would cover, you know, the negotiations so that, you know, nobody would know that they were they were merging with the Rothschilds, but I guess Congress didn't allow it or something. That was in Ron Chernow's book. But the prize runs down all of that about Baku. That mm-hmm. was the biggest oil area, you know. So it was like all these Nobel Prizes are kind of the same negotiations always of controlling both sides,
it
the Bolsheviks and the communists or whatever.
Well, you know, when somebody like Henry Kissinger gets the Nobel Peace Prize, you have to wonder.
And the Nazis. When what?
And Henry Kissinger got the Nobel Peace Prize 1 year.
Well, there's a lot of questionable. There's a lot of, you know, the eugenicists got a lot of.
Oh, a lot of people. Well, that's true. Yes.
Well, it seems like you liberals or progressives are real concerned about genetic engineering of plants, but you seem to think that all the stem cell research and all that genetics is, you know, really progressive.
I don't think that. I think genetics can be misused very, you know. In other words, you know, any kind of scientific knowledge can be used for humane ends or inhumane ends.
It's well, kind Margaret of a, Sanger wasn't any too humane.
That's what I've
people,
heard. I
all
don't
the
know
birth
that.
Control, the mm-hmm. zero population growth,
well,
all
heard
the
that.
Progressive stuff that you've put through. I've never heard it discussed, NSSM 200 discussed on KABU.
I've looked that
was,
up.
That was classified for 15 years.
I did try and look it up. Maybe I did. Tell us more
how
about
how Roe versus Wade, you know, was right in that period before anybody knew that we were spending money on telling the third world not to reproduce, but meanwhile we're working on fertility so gay men can have babies.
Well, now we're getting a little off field here. What is in NSM?
Well, that's how they're using gays. I feel real sorry for them.
Well,
because
I don't know if they're being used or not, but
eventually
I'd like to get
they'll
back.
Want to, you know, off those people, just like they've always wanted to off blacks and off any, you know.
Well, the people who run the world will use anybody in furtherance
in fact,
of their
Davis
aims, you know.
Planned Parenthood was a conspiracy against blacks, but somehow that got dropped along the line.
Well, we're getting kind of off topic. It's very interesting what you said about Baku, and obviously we need to learn more about that part of the world because it's going to affect our futures very much. So thanks for calling. And I think we have another caller on the air. Hi, you're on the air if you're there. Do we have another caller?
Yeah.
Hi, you're on the air.
I had a moment of enlightenment this morning.
Oh, okay.
George Bush is over there in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And with the same old evildoer speech, and he says, I'm confident Osama bin Laden will be brought to justice.
Oh, he said.
And when he said that, I thought, who in the world can bring George Bush to justice? Nobody. And the whole world is conned on this war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Carla Del Ponte, she goes around trying to get the Serbs to The Hague.
All right, okay.
She doesn't get the Israelis or the Americans to The Hague.
Well, it's what we call selective outrage, you know. There are some war criminals go on trial and other war criminals skate free. So.
And poor old Saddam Hussein, he's over there saying, just blame me, don't involve my brothers.
Well, you know, I would like that trial to go into the history of Saddam's ties with the U.S., you know. That would be very interesting.
Oh, it's in books. I've got a book called Reagan's Secret Wars, and all that stuff is in there, but nobody listens.
Mm-hmm. Well, we try and find out what we can and publicize it.
I want to ask you one more quote.
Sure.
At the start of World War II, Neville Chamberlain said, "America and the world Jews forced me into the war."
Well,
is that true?
I kind of doubt that. I think the war was brought about by a lot of different people, and I wouldn't single out any particular one group of them. It seems to me the people responsible for World War One and Two, it goes back to the politics of empire. So
the British Empire.
Well, British Empire. The Germans wanted their empire. The French wanted to keep theirs. I mean, it just that's sort of the real culprit is just the imperial kind of mindset. Anyway, thanks for your call. Let's go on to our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes.
Yeah, I think a lot of. It's a favorite pastime, especially of the liberal group, to point out hypocrisies and inconsistencies, and it's fun and everything, but I think this, regarding a lot of issues that are the larger issues now in the United States and worldwide, I think need to be looked at through a different lens. We should probably be looking at things, what I have a degree in political science and what political science 101, where you basically look through different issues or at different issues through different paradigms of, for instance, we looked at things from the point of view of dictators and then cultures and, then there's the so-called conspiracy theories. And at this point, I don't think there is the conspiracies have gone. It's pretty much evident what's happening now. We have a global corporate system that has superseded all governments.
Mm-hmm.
And, what's happening right now is the American people are being told on all the larger issues that we're held hostage to basically either a local economy, a global economy, the oil, a favorite theory of people right now that the war in Iraq is over oil. It's really not about the oil at all. It's about American currency being used as a global means of trade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And although I can't deny that, right now the really only value behind the dollar is energy, it's not necessarily Middle Eastern oil.
For instance,
what happened right here... recently, we're being told we can't protect our borders because we need illegal, well, they don't say illegal, but they're calling it guest workers.
Mm-hmm.
But what they really mean is we need people who are willing to work without the protections of law.
That's true. They get exploited by the companies they work for. But I think one thing, this global trade has done in Central America is kind of pushed people off the land because they can't compete with these subsidized U.S. farms. So they lose their land, they go into the cities, and when you do that, you're going to create a whole lot of people who have really no recourse but to try and go where the money is, which is in the United States. So it's part of a much larger kind of a global a system that's in disarray, that's hurting a lot of people. So, there's a lot of things that people need to think about as far as immigration goes, but there is a bigger picture that pushes, that makes this happen. So,
sure, and what we're looking at with Israel, I mean, we give them, I think it's something like $13 million a month.
Whatever
is that what it is, or is it a year?
I don't know what though. I think there's more than $13 million a year.
Yeah, it's got. I think it is $13 million a month. I haven't looked at the figures recently, but it's a huge amount of money.
Right.
And people complain about that, but they also complain about the high oil prices. But if Americans understood how this economy worked, they'd know that what we're doing really is we're dumping on the rest of the world. We are exporting our inflation.
That's right.
The next time you drive up to the pump, you're helping to prop up the dollar. You're hurting other people, of course, but that's why it's a little bit more difficult than looking at this just one country versus another country, or one people versus another people,
that's
the Fukuyama culture wars are not happening. This is not a, they'd like to, I'm sure a contingent would like to see that happen.
Well,
and there is a lot of racism nascent in this country right now, but it's not about the race. It's about these, you know, they'll bring you alternative energy if they can keep their money in power. They'll bring you peace if they can keep their money in power. The two historically have not gone together very well.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Tara. I'm always delighted when you are hosting, wherever you're hosting.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. And I came in kind of late on the show, but I'm just kind of wondering about this little trip to Afghanistan for our boy in the bubble.
Oh, yes.
Is it just to go check on the poppy crop?
Is he what?
To go check on the poppy crop? Is he there to check on the poppy crop to make
sure that? I think, Hamid Karzai is going to kiss his ring and everything and praise him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, one of the worst things about the U.S. empire is that, you know, any mediocre, half-witted politician who gets into the White House can go around the world like he runs the world. You know, this is really kind of disgusting when you think about it.
Yeah, this particular one, I mean, I've always kind of felt like it's pretty disgusting, but this is just over the top. This administration is way over the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's out there on a daily basis embarrassing the American people, and worst of all, he's out there embarrassing Jesus, for God's sake.
Oh, boy.
So,
well,
anyway, and I'm sure he's checking on the poppy crop to see how fast we can get that heroin out on the street.
Well,
so we
knows?
Can keep more people debilitated.
And keep the banks, keep the bubble going, whatever.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Okay. For those who are listening, this is what's coming up this morning at 9 o'clock, the KBOO Bike Show. We'll interview local bike tour organizers, and Sara will give an update on the state of New York City's critical mass. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller and guests will speak about the recent WTO interim ruling on the U.S.-EU dispute over genetically modified organisms. At 10:30, Carlos Chavez host an update on the current situation regarding the rights of immigrants in the U.S. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And then tune in tonight at 5 for KBOO Evening News, followed by Free Speech Radio News. And at 6, Circle A Radio will speak with anti-nuclear activists, past and present, to answer the question, whatever happened to the anti-nuclear movement? They will also discuss the Bush administration's push towards expanded nuclear weapons manufacturing and the controversial storage proposal for the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste site in Nevada. So all these things are coming up on KBOO. So stay tuned. And now let's do we have another caller? Yes, we do. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. The money that we've been giving to Israel for some time, I would like to, I want to see it given to either for the school problems here, or to the victims of Katrina, or even to the Palestine people, Palestinian people that are having a problem living over there. I suppose it would take a big campaign or something to stop that money from going to Israel. Anyway, also, I want to ask you something. I don't know if you can answer. It may not be. I know there's a lot of mafias in this country, Mexican, Russian, and I don't know what else. But
right.
And when you talk about the Italian mafia, some people think that you're being prejudiced against it. But does anybody honestly know, have real information? Do they have an awful lot of the Italian mafia? Do they have a lot of political power or control in our country, or has that been exaggerated?
Well, I don't know. I think
I'm thinking. I don't know if it's been established that they were behind the Kennedys being killed, whatever, or not. But so I just wonder.
Well,
about that.
the Italian mafia, I mean, they were pretty big in some East Coast cities like, you know, New York and Boston.
But what about Las Vegas? I heard something.
Well, yeah, in Chicago, and mm-hmm. I think, yeah, they were involved in Las Vegas. So, I mean, sure, they had a lot of clout. I mean,
they still do.
Well, I don't know if they have as much power as they used to. You know, of course, the Italian mafia replaced gangsters of other nationalities.
Yeah, I'm surprised at that, yes.
And, you know, one thing that happens with these various gangsters is they make their bundle of money, you know, in sort of criminal enterprises, and then they go respectable. You know, they kind of launder their money, and they go into legitimate business, and they... hey, Joe Kennedy was an example of that. He made his money in bootlegging back in the 20s, and then later on, I think he bought Seagram's Distillery or something, and he launched his sons on political careers, you know. So,
nobody can really get real clear, honest information because they're like a secret group. Different mafias, and they have a secrecy that they honor with each other.
That's true. And the Sicilians call it omertà. You know, you don't speak, you don't rat your friends, you know. And so, I don't know.
Well, thanks a lot.
There's a lot of stuff written about the mafia, so I don't have any titles offhand, but I know there are some very good books. Okay, let's go on to our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Pierre.
Good morning.
Thanks for a great discussion. I wanted to recommend Amy Goodman's program yesterday, Democracy Now.
Uh-huh.
She interviewed John Pace.
Okay.
Who was the leading UN human rights official in Iraq, and he emphasized that the real model is El Salvador and not Vietnam.
Okay.
That... the militias entered into the vacuum that was created with the invasion,
mm-hmm.
and that the militias actually seized control of the government, that in El Salvador, a right-wing government fought the progressives, and extrajudicial killings
right.
kind of dominated the death squads. Now, last week, according to Democracy Now!, either 1,300 or 1,500 Iraqis were killed.
Mm-hmm.
An incredible event, which just shows that our occupation is increasing, terrorism,
mm-hmm.
And that Iraqis are united in wanting the end to our occupation. That we have been bewitched by, in an Orwellian way, you know, in identifying freedom with occupation.
Well, yeah, you know, the U.S. has these sort of special forces operating in Iraq too, and it was sort of modeled on the Phoenix program of the Vietnam War. And so when you hear about these bombings and things like that, you know, you have to really wonder who is doing it. A lot of Iraqis really believe, and they may be right, is that some of these bombings were done by these U.S. and British special forces squads. So it's getting really hard to figure things out.
Well, we are a country that refuses to see the writing on the wall,
mm-hmm.
refuses to respond to wake up calls.
Mm-hmm.
And that cannot connect the dots.
Well, eventually we're going to have to. So,
I mean, having a pyromaniac in charge of the fire department is is the last thing that you want.
There we go. Well, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
I think we have another caller on the line. Hi, you're on the air. Hello? Hey, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Yes. You had a caller a little while ago that mentioned... Bush's trip to stopover in Afghanistan as being mm-hmm. a little questionable.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the same, and wasn't it just yesterday or the day before that some scandal came up about a torturing in a prison in Afghanistan?
Well, I know there's been talk about that.
I think it was in Bagram, I believe.
Yeah, Bagram Air Force Base, yes. I think that's been going on for quite a while, and it's
the timing is a little bit strange, I think. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, do we have another caller on the line? Hi, you're on the air. Let's get to our next caller. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Well, that was quick. Sorry, I have a bad throat going on, but I'll try and make it brief. I had a question, and I saw in the paper the other day, said Saddam Hussein was a Sunni. And I have never heard this before, and it was on the front page of the Borgonian in an article about Iraq, and that's about as far as I went when I saw that. I thought, man, I don't know. I think that's BS, but I'm not sure. So I was wondering if anybody out there knew if Saddam Hussein was indeed a Sunni. And two, I think that, you know, it looks, and that was a Knight Rider news story. I don't remember the name of the author of it. But anyway, two, I'm wondering also, you know, if they're starting to lean towards the Sunnis. You know, they're calling it the Sunni insurgency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and starting to, the propaganda is starting to slide now to, oh, it's the Sunnis, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first it was the insurgencies, first it was Al-Qaeda, then it was just the insurgencies, and now it's the Sunni insurgency.
Well, I think they're thrashing around. The U.S. is, as far as Saddam goes, I believe he comes from a Sunni background, but as far as I know, he was never particularly religious for most of his life. In the last few years, when the war, before the war, he kind of made a show of building mosques and having photo ops of him praying and things like that, but I don't think he was ever particularly religious.
We all know that world leaders get off on doing that.
Well, I think world leaders get off on a lot of bad things.
Really.
Anyway, yes.
Well, I'll take my nasty old voice off the air and keep listening. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, I don't know if we have another caller on the line. We do. Okay, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Per Fogren. This is
Richard Koenig. Good morning.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about you as a host.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison in Portland with the information that you generate, and by generating, I mean encourage people to contribute and share.
Well, knowledge is power, and we need some more power for ourselves. You
are one of the most empowering people radio in Portland today, mm-hmm. and I want to thank you for that. I watch your community grow as you water it with knowledge.
Well,
and I am so, you know, I see people coming out. People respond to you so well and you encourage them. I just wanted to say thank you. That's all I got to say.
Well, thank you. I learned a bit from one caller a while ago who talked about the Azeris. That's he was telling me stuff that I didn't know, and that was very interesting. So
I understand that you are learning, and you're giving people an opportunity to teach you. You are accepting of people's input, and that's exactly my point. You are a resource not only for information that you provide, but a resource for people to flock around and share.
Well, thank you very much.
You're a sharing resource.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, do we have another caller on the line?
Hello, Per.
Hi, you're on the air.
Per?
Yes.
Did that previous caller compare you to fertilizer?
Yeah, growing mushrooms, you know.
Well, I just wanted to bring up briefly, what do you think the possibilities of, in the future, the United States joining the International Criminal Court and allowing the relatively young, healthy George W. to be indicted for international war crimes?
Right, that'd be a good idea. Why not? Yes.
I'm kind of glad that George W. is exercising an awful lot because he might be with us for another 20, 25 years and gives us plenty of opportunity to bring him before the International Bar of Justice.
Well, do you think they're going to... I don't think he'd get reelected if they ever changed that two-term rule, for one thing. But I don't know. What do you think he'd be doing 20 years from now? That's interesting.
Well, it'd probably be, let's see, with Halliburton or one of the other private equity firms.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, he's subject to international indictment. I think Kissinger might end up dying off before they can get him before international justice. But perhaps times will, the pendulum might swing back. The United States might get its senses and will end up joining with the international community, and that even our wayward presidents can actually be hauled before an international tribunal. And crimes against humanity is one thing, but this war against Iraq was a crime against peace, which is one of the under-mentioned Geneva Conventions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, we can always hope. You know, maybe life is full of surprises, so maybe there'll be some good surprises ahead.
Well, thank you, Pierre.
Thank you. Okay, I think we have another caller. Hi, you're on, hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, all that trip just for a bundle of skeezag to Afghanistan?
I don't know.
Hey, years ago, there was like a New York Times obituary.
Mm-hmm.
It was when George Bush's dad, number 41, mm-hmm. his partner died. They talked about how they had formed Zapata Oil. And then that was the offshore smuggling of drugs, right? They could mm-hmm. bypass customs. And then they took over Pennzoil, and then mm-hmm. Pennzoil took over Chevron.
Uh-huh.
And that's the Bush connection, I think, into Chevron and the personal affront in Kuwait,
mm-hmm.
besides the Queen, personally ripped off by Saddam. That's the big thing that they have about him. But, yeah, the labs are ready. The product's coming out. Maybe Air Force One might have to be shaken down when it hits the ground, man.
It's still there?
Yeah.
Oh, well, who knows? You know, I mean, Bush, I think, is... As far as I can gather, his big visit was with India, you know, because he's pushing this some kind of a nuclear deal with India while he is not allowing Iran to do what it has every right to do, which is nuclear energy. So I don't know if the trip to Afghanistan was kind of like a little sideshow or what, but he, you know, he goes there to get... you know,
pick up some product or pick up some cash, man.
Well, or just get lavishly praised by Karzai, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, Caesar's going around the world getting his tributes, you know.
Working for the company, worried about God.
Yeah, that's right.
Working for God. Gold, oil, and drugs.
Well, maybe when he retires from the White House, he'll go back to his childhood pastime of blowing up frogs. Who knows?
Maybe your buddy Mike knows a lot about this trip to Afghanistan.
Well, we'll find out. We'll find out.
Talk to you later, man.
Okay, thank you. Well, I guess we have no more callers right now. The last one brought up, Bush's trip to India and Afghanistan. And there's a very good article by Arundhati Roy, and it's headlined, Baby Bush, Go Home. And she writes, this is in the Guardian, if you want to get that on your website. Whoop, do we have a caller? Okay, let's take our caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Pat, how are you doing?
Pretty good.
Hey, good. I'm excited about the prospects of taking out Iran's nuclear capabilities. I think that would serve the entire world.
It would?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, we don't want Iran to have this kind of capability, because if they do, even if it is 3 to 10 years off, like that kookhead guest you had said, if you don't stop it now, they it's going to be worse 3 to 10 years down the road. So,
well, one
I, the fact of going into a nation again and taking out their nuclear weapon with our military really excites me. I think that's a good thing. It's good for our country.
Hey, you gonna volunteer?
You bet. Yeah. If I was young enough, I'd be more than happy to volunteer.
Well, you know, one person says that the kind of uranium that they have could never make weapons anyway. So,
well,
I mean,
we don't know that. You don't know that. I don't know that. But, you know, I do trust our government.
You
and
do?
They know what they've
oh,
got.
My
yes,
gosh.
I do. So I think it's a good thing. I hope we go in there sooner than later.
Oh, boy. I don't know. I don't. I wouldn't know.
My son's in the military, and he's in Afghanistan right now, and they're excited about it. Because they know
that right?
They're doing a lot. He just came from Iraq and went to Afghanistan. And he said the people are thrilled of what we're doing there.
Hey, let me say one last thing before I have to sign off soon. But this is what Henry Kissinger said about soldiers. This is Henry Kissinger. He said, quote, military men are dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy. That is Henry Kissinger talking, and that's what's going on these days.
Kind of like the KBOO crowd that you guys got.
Well, thanks, thanks for your call. I think my time is up because the bike people are out in the hallway, and so thank you for listening, thank you for calling, and stay tuned.
It's 2 minutes after 9 a.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on the KBOO Radio Zine, the KBOO Bike Show will interview local bike tour organizers, and Sara will give an update on the state of New York City critical mass. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller and guests will speak about the recent WTO interim ruling on the United States-European Union dispute over genetically modified organisms. At 10:30, Carlos Chavez hosts an update on the current situation regarding the rights of immigrants in the United States. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And tune in tonight at 5 for the KBOO Evening News, followed by Free Speech Radio News. At 6, Circle A Radio will speak with anti-nuclear activists past and present to answer the question, whatever happened to the anti-nuclear movement? They will also discuss the Bush administration's push toward expanded nuclear weapons manufacturing and the controversial storage proposal for the Yucca Mountain nuclear site, waste site in Nevada.